And we are back with episode 313 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and as someone's mother might say after downing a bottle of wine, plus ça change, plus ça reste le même.
Gary from Jacksonville, and wow, you know, some of those late-night bar meetings can actually produce things. I'm pretty impressed.
And this is Brunson from Australia, and after all this time, we're back to writing memos.
And hey, you know, all I can say is that the Regent legal system makes a lot more sense of a lot of the weird legal decisions we've seen in the world lately. Let me tell you. All right, we are going to be talking about Mad Men, Warehouse 13, and Defiance, and then a whole slew of quick hits. But before we get to any of that, Edmund, if you could please.
We will talk about all aspects of these episodes, so we must warn you that you will be spoiled. But we've waited about a week or so before we do that, so we certainly hope you've caught up.
Yes, indeed. And we are going to start with Mad Men. And, well, for what it's worth, here's the promo.
On the next episode of AMC's Mad Men.
So you want something?
Why can't you handle it?
I want her out.
How long is he staying?
You've already done all you can do.
Could you give us a moment? We'll continue this later.
Pete, no.
For more Mad Men video, go to AMC.com.
Always so helpful. Okay, and, well, this is so much more helpful as well. Mad Men, Season 6, Episode 6, for immediate release. Roger changes tack to make new business. Pete has an awkward run-in with a client. Yeah, wow, that leaves a lot
Jeez.
Out. This episode was, for all that I feel like we've been saying that this has been a slow start to the season, and it wasn't until last episode that we really felt like something hit that was a bit shocking to the system. This episode was like the crack in the dam just exploding. And just from the very beginning of the episode, people were just losing it completely. And it seemed like every scene was just more and more damning for everybody involved. And I actually physically cringed at least once an act throughout this episode. Just how awkward and terrible it was for these people. And yet at the end, you get the sense that they might actually be on the path towards the next step in the next stage and everything. So, we've talked a little bit about here and there and in many cases where this particular time period is very turbulent. And I'm getting the sense that that's where the theme is finally kicking in, not just in terms of directly addressing history as the previous episode did, but certainly in this episode, it felt like everything was just in flux and just going completely downhill. In many cases. Wow, I don't even know where to start except for that's probably the absolute worst situation to meet your father-in-law in. That just, I just felt so just wrong, bad for Pete, and that never happened, so that made me feel wrong, and yeah, it was just, anyway. Gary, how about you? What were your thoughts on this episode? Gary?
Oh, sorry about that. Something took over my computer and I was hearing rap music. I thought I was at the new Great Gatsby movie. Anyway, because nothing says 1920s like rap music. Anyway, so.
Apply a damp cloth and ointment to the burn.
Yes. No, I thought there was a lot of good. It wasn't, as the caption that you read off earlier says, Roger changes tack. I don't think he changed tack. We just got the original Roger back. is sort of what I felt. Like he's now, I guess, gone through all his breakups, breakdowns, and he's sort of getting back to business again, not to beat somebody else, but because he enjoys doing it. You see the sort of smile on the actor's face, and you can tell he's home. This is the type of stuff he likes to do. This is why Roger is in the agency to begin with, to drum up new business in a way that, you know, only he can. And in some ways, at least, it does pay off. It pays off well. They, you know, they get a lead on General Motors, which is a huge account. It's almost hard to contemplate in this day and age with bankruptcies and stuff like this, how large a company General Motors was in the 60s. They were the largest company in the world by far. So it's quite a gem and a jewel. You know, they had talked about car companies for a few seasons now as they'd like to get one someday. When they got Jaguar, then maybe one day they'll be able to get a big company. And here it is. So in a way, they have been building to this account for several seasons. So it's sort of nice to see that they are reaching fruition in that sense. One of my personal favorites about this episode is Peggy and how you see she's just getting so frustrated. You know, here she is getting, you know, at least, well, she's frustrated in two different senses in this episode. But I will start with the first one being she's frustrated with her boyfriend. You know, he's got this sort of, I'm trying to think of a polite way to put it, but just, you know, that he wants to be this sort of like every man, and he doesn't want to have any wealth or show off that he's, you know, living nicely or something like this. He's looking for like the sort of bare minimum to get by on. And, you know, there was a sense of this in that time that, you know, that you shouldn't drain society's resources, that you should live, you know, very frugally and things along that line, and experience life, not, you know, not sort of, you know, buy it. And so Peggy's reaching this sort of frustration point, and I was almost wondering if she was going to blow this episode, but if she doesn't go this one, I have high hopes for the next episode that something's going to fall out from that. That being said, switching to other women, we see Joan that is still reeling with the fact of Don dropping Jaguar and the effects that it's, you know, is going to have on her and her pocketbook. So that's an interesting little scene, but I didn't feel that they went too much into that. The big thing, of course, is the meeting with Don and the other agency. They're sitting there basically once again trying to work over the same customer, and then Don actually I didn't think got it first, which was sort of interesting. They usually try to show Don so much as the plotter and schemer that it was interesting that he sort of picked up late on this. And maybe this is something that they're again continuing to push about, you know, the younger people and sort of them getting things quicker than some of the older staff. And, you know, they present this whole thing about that there's no way they're going to get this large General Motors account. The agencies, quite frankly, are just too small to even really handle it properly. And so they're going to get raided for ideas, and then they're going to just basically, you know, get cast to the wind until they realize that if they work together, then they might be big enough and they'd have a good shot at this amazing, you know, contract, this coup. So they eventually come together, and you can sort of see as they make the announcements, or at least Don's making the announcement with the other ad agent, and you see Peggy hear about it, and you can just see her again, her just, you know, frustration and anger. And I can see, like, you know, she worked so hard and she just got away from Don and she's getting her life, you know, she's getting recognized and, you know, appreciated. And now she's working under Don again. Yeah. As if all her efforts and hard work and everything she's done for the last about a year at this point, or nearly, it's like, was all for naught, because where is she? Right back under Don's thumb again. I was almost waiting for them to ask her to get coffee. I mean, it was pretty bad. But that being said, Don's never been that much of a team player, in my opinion. So I don't know how long this sort of team up can work or how integrated they will be. But in one sense, it's not a bad thing. It does breathe a little new life into, you know, with whatever they're going to call the company. So I think the interplay can be nice, and it'll give us, you know, some fresh things to work through as this season and hopefully the next, you know, continue to go. But it was an enjoyable show. I wish I could say it sort of had more high points for me, but it didn't. There was a lot of, I sort of felt like, you know, anger growing and stuff like that. Roger's moments were probably the most lighthearted and fun, and it was nice to finally get the Roger back. I never enjoyed the moping character much.
Yeah, you know, you bring up the part about Peggy, and I think that was probably the one that hit the hardest, because I found myself a little frustrated with her reaction, because if she really had a chance to maybe step back and think in terms of think in the way that she was when she decided to strike out on her own and see it as the best move for her, I'm wondering if objectively she could see that being brought in on the ground floor of a merge like this is a really good place for her to be. If she could just kind of jump in and be kind of like that
I think if it was anyone else but Don, she would.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that's the point.
In a strictly professional sense, they do make the point. Like, she's now this company is actually like now a real player. This group thing, and she is one of the chief copywriters, possibly the copy. You know, it's a really really great position. It's not about the professional consequences.
No,
it's
but
about
it's all her. Yeah, that's exactly it. She's letting that personal part kind of override it, and I was a little bit frustrated because it's like, please tell me she's not going to spend the rest of the season squandering this opportunity, because we've seen so many characters on the show do that before, and when she did leave, it was a big step for any of them to take. And while I can see her taking this almost as like, you know, fate kind of smacking her upside the head and smacking her down because now she's got to work under Don again, I don't know. It seems to me like she would, or she should, if she's the person that she's trying to be, kind of take this and make the most of it. Where I see a lot of other characters just not doing that at all, and feeling like they, you know, especially if she does embrace it, they would almost see it as being left out again. As particularly Pete, in the way that his mental space is right now, I can't imagine he's going to take it very well. I mean, he was just going absolutely over the top in some of these situations, and when he just started laying into Don in the stairwell, and with everybody staring at them, it was the heat was definitely on. So I can see him taking things in a very personal way. But sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to override completely. Brunson, how about you? What are your thoughts on this one?
That it was one of the more exciting episodes of Mad Men that I've seen in a long while, because I mean it's the show's always incredibly rich and interesting, but it's sort of a slower paced story. And even though this is much slower paced compared to a lot of the other things we talk about on Critical Myth, it felt exciting. Things were happening quickly, and we're just sort of caught in this in this whirlwind of things falling apart and something great kind of building up at the same time, and this tension between them, like can they get their stuff together before everything's gone, you know, completely gone to the dogs? It was really really great. I mean, and the way they did all this stuff with you know, having the old Roger back and just having a really really fun performance and a fun storyline that winds up being sort of the key to the whole second half of the episode, I thought it was great. I thought it was all the stuff with Pete was interesting, but it felt like a little bit of a diversion from what I was really really interested in seeing more of. It was nice to see Don so enthused again. It was nice to see everyone so enthused again. It felt like we hadn't seen a lot of that for a long while. But then it's contrasted with everyone's reaction to Jaguar falling through, and Jones in particular. Like, that was the one that was really, really rough to see, because so much is going unspoken, but it feels like pretty much everyone in the room understands the hows and whys, and it was...
Well, I think Joan pretty much did lay it out to Don, right? You know, right there, and saying, you know...
Well, I mean, in the sense, like, of course Don understands what's, you know, what happened in the first place, so that, you know, they could get the Jaguar account, but not necessarily everyone in... I don't think everyone in the room necessarily understood as well, even though it was the majority of them were the partners. But yeah, she just kind of ripped into him, and it was quick, but it was brutal, and it was so well deserved, because a lot of Don's real disgust over this guy has been over what happened with Joan, and it's that kind of, I think there is, you know, on Don's part, it's like a genuine resentment for that thing, and yet he winds up using it to just it winds up completely screwing everyone else over. It was.
Well, I thought
pride is the right one.
Yeah.
Oh, you go.
Well, I was just saying, I felt that was the first time I think we got a sense of Joan's the cost that Joan paid. You know, she was sort of quiet and demure after it happened, but this was the first time I really felt she let out what it cost her. This was the first time I had a sense of it. You know, she did, and she's like, "Oh, I expect to be partner," and you never got a sense of course, something like that would affect someone, but you never had a sense of the depth until that line to Don. You know, why couldn't you suck it up, like, you know, like basically like I did. You know, I gave, you know, everything for this, and you're, you know, a few bad comments about your work and you're dumping it. It's like, you don't know what I have into this account. And I never had that sort of sense that it weighed that strongly on her.
I definitely had the sense it was weighing on her, especially after that earlier episode where she's getting her authority challenged by Harry. And it's just like everything I had to go through and I was supposed to be in a much better position. And yet I'm still getting treated like a glorified secretary.
Yeah, I know. I mean, my sense of that whole exchange was, the other thing that was going on was the fact that, here's Don, blowing in here saying, we got this great, yes, we lost Jaguar, we got this great thing going on. And of course, this is completely blowing up their work on the ongoing public, that very opening scene, where the assessor, the accountant, was complimenting her on her work, it's just another acknowledgement of, it may be the unglamorous paperwork and things that she does, but she is extremely good at it. And having, and here's Dawn coming in saying, oh yes, but we've got this wonderful thing that, I think she's well aware that, yes, at that point, the likelihood of them actually getting it is slim. So, it's like, he's just destroyed her nest egg. And there's even, going back to the actual incident last season, there was that whole irony of, they were keeping Don out of the loop, but then when he finally found out and went, went to try and warn her, warn her about doing it. And it was after the fact. I mean, it was after she'd already gotten back. Especially given their wonderful bar scene last season as well. It's kind of like, if she had heard from him beforehand, she might not have gone ahead with it. So there's all sorts of dynamics in that. And throughout the episode, you really got this sense of things kind of spiraling out of control. I mean, between, what's going on in Peggy's life, and the whole Jaguar thing's blowing up, and Roger's, seemingly sort of indulging himself, running around with this stewardess, because yes, that's what they were called then, and I do love how much more helpful stewardesses were back then, and then to have all of that happening, and then to have it tie back into, what they'd already set up with Hines, and there'd been this sort of speculation and, talk about, are they going to merge? And I know with this episode, the moment it opened up with going over those financials, it was kind of in the back of my head all episode. So then when it came up at the bar, it was like, good, you are actually going to go for it. And I actually did like that. I think once again, it's this whole thing that Don's been kind of off his game, whether it was that hotel pitch that, yes, looked like he was going to commit suicide. And even when the two of them are going, giving each other their pitches, I think Ted's was a bit better than Don's, just aside from the business aspect of it, it's like, Don, needed to hear that from Joan and, get a little off his high horse and, maybe realize it does need to be a bit more of a team and, let some other people into the process so that, they can actually grow. But to have it, everything's, seemed to be so dire and then pull it out at the end with that merger and, and all the new ramifications that brings. I just thought it was a really, really nice, nice step forward for this season.
Definitely. Henry gave this one, I believe, let me just confirm. You'd think that I would remember this since it's right there on the page. 8 out of 10. Bronson, how about you? What would you give it?
I think I'm more inclined to go as high as a 9. I haven't been so engaged with an episode of Mad Men for a long time, and even though, like some of the previous ones, it's not the entire thing that's engaging me. There's little bits that I'm not finding as interesting. I was glued to the screen more than Mad Men has sort of been able to pull off in a while for me, and just in addition to being so rich in the characters and the detail, was just this sense of movement of things happening, and I came away from it with a sense of, that the character's hope and, their hopes and the dread and the nervousness and the excitement and just looking to the future and seeing what's going to happen. And so I was so impressed with it.
How about you, Gary?
I was trying to think about what to give it. And then I start saying, I thought Don's scene was nice. Joan's scene was nice. Peggy's both scenes were nice, and I just keep adding up good scene after good scene after good scene. I think I'm going to go with Bronstum's 9. This had a lot of great points to it. I wouldn't say that necessarily was all one story, but all the points were just hit very well.
Edmund, how about you?
Best episode of the season. It's a 9.
I think I'm going to also go with a 9 because, Bronstum, you put it best. This was the first episode in a very long time, certainly this season, that just left me completely enthralled. I was just waiting to see what the next scene was going to bring. And how often have we been able to say that about Mad Men? Pretty much since last season and some of the big moments that came along there that we did not see coming. So, yeah, that's going to be clearly the winner so far this season. And I guess the only thing that's really shocking is that it's the middle of the season and we're hitting this. So far, this season has been well behind where they were last season, in the fifth season. And this is the first episode. The last two have been the episodes that have kind of brought it back to where it had been as far as where we had been, what we had felt about the show. So I'm hoping that this is a sign of things to come and that it's not going to slip back into the kind of slow, very average type of material that we'd seen up to this point. I'm hoping that this is them getting back on track. All right, well, speaking of shows that are back on the air, at least, let's go ahead and switch gears to Warehouse 13, and here's the promo.
On Sci-Fi's Powerful Monday, an all-new Warehouse 13.
Did Arthur Nielsen kill Lena?
Artie might be back.
It wasn't Artie.
But can never be the same.
Ow! Let us help you.
Warehouse 13, an original series, all new this Monday at 10, only on Sci-Fi's Powerful Mondays.
Okay, and let's see. Bronstum, why don't you go ahead and do the recap for us here?
Warehouse 13, Season 4, Episode 12, Parks and Rehabilitation. That is an awesome title, I have to mention. Pete and Claudia investigate murders involving a radical environmentalist group while Artie tries to get back to work, but the warehouse has another opinion. This isn't the first time that the show sort of mucked around with different partnerings for the various characters, and every time they do, it works really, really well. I mean, Pete and Mike have obviously always had a really, really good rapport, and part of why we like Jinx so much when he first showed up is that he and Claudia would just had a great dynamic immediately. That complemented sort of her great dynamic with Artie, and but it's nice to sort of put the characters in a different configuration and be reminded that they're all just really, really fun characters, and it's really fun to see them do pretty much anything. And then the way that, you know, the various sort of plot lines that have to deal with the artifact hiccups, it's all like fairly typical Warehouse 13 fair, like, and I mean that in a good way. Although we have sort of from time to time been a bit annoyed at the show being repetitive, it's got a basic formula that actually does work, and that personally, you know, I tend to enjoy more often than not. But it was bolstered by some nice sort of character threads weaved in the middle of it, and having Claudia and Artie in particular just sort of deal with the repercussions of what happened in the big sort of two-parter that was split across a year. Not bitter at all about that. Yeah, that was sort of really nice. Even I'll admit that, I mean, that obviously set up that Claudia was still apprehensive and guilty about what she'd had to do to help free Artie. But I didn't quite see such a neat metaphor coming until he actually voiced it at the very end of the episode. In the meantime, Artie is he's not just fun, but Saul Rubinek is a great actor, and he's always been good at bringing a really sympathetic quality to the character. And it was kind of painful to see him in such bad shape after what happened. Made the joke about the regent justice system earlier in the episode, and the idea that of course, like, they very quickly, very easily recognize the truth about what happened, that despite the fact that Lena's dead, it's only if you look at the absolute strictest technicalities that you can blame Artie. It's not, you know, he wasn't the one, you know, in charge of himself. And, you know, it's very obvious to see that to everyone but Artie, and him struggling with that was it was a great thread to run through that storyline. And then, of course, the Claudia Arty reunion at the very end was just... Those two are great. They could just be the show to themselves.
Yeah. How about you, Gary? What did you think of this episode?
Oh, no, I liked it a lot. I thought it was really good. Honest, one thing I disliked that I'm not sure if it's the first time I noticed it, but maybe it's been going on for a while. We used to get a much better sort of history of the artifact that's being under question, and I didn't feel like we got much of that story at all. I always liked the little tidbits they throw in about the artifacts, and we didn't really get that for the Lantern. So I was sort of, you know, I was a little disappointed. I'm always a gadgets guy in the first place, so I usually like the little twists of history and stories that they come up with for those things. So that was a little part that I missed. That being said, I'll call it the B plot, which was the actual artifact plot. It didn't do much for me, honestly, except it did. I feel like they're showing Pete in a better light. He's not quite as dopey, I guess, as he had been in the past. They are showing a little bit more competent. Not that he can't throw off a few quips and things here and there, but just generally towards the end of last year, they were really making him seem blatantly stupid. And it seems like they've pulled back from that a little bit. The scene with Artie and the with the Regents was interesting. However, the one line that sort of I made scratch the back of my head was, oh, that is much worse than any punishment we could come up with. Really? I think you guys, the Regents, would probably come up with some pretty good punishments if they wanted to. So that's like, wow, you already have bronzing and all these other different types of things that you torture people with. I'm sure you could come up with a great punishment for somebody if they really wanted to. So, but that being said, the forgiveness between with Artie was nice on everybody's side. Nobody really held him responsible, and so I sort of liked how everyone had this sense of family. Everybody wanted to help him. You know, it wasn't just like, you know, it wasn't just Claudia. It was everyone that wanted to, you know, try and get him back on the back to, I guess, his previous self. It was also nice to see some of the things that. Oh, geez, why am I blanking out on her name?
Lena.
That Lena had actually done around there other than, you know, work at the boarding house and sit in the office. You know, wow, she actually did serve a purpose. Of course, it took till she was posthumously to find out about it, but now we know she did have some purposes in the warehouse. So that I thought that was a nice little thing for them to throw in after it doesn't matter as much anymore. But it did at least answer some of our questions about what the heck does why'd they have her here? Well, now we know. It was to sit in the Wheel of Fortune and decide where the different artifacts went. So, but I'm mocking it, but at the same time, I thought it was nice to sort of show that she did have a purpose and that it wasn't the easiest purpose and not everyone can do it. So I thought that was sort of paying a nice little bit of credit to the character, even after they're gone. So as much as we earlier often wondered why they didn't kill off Lena earlier on in the series, at least I felt like they handled it reverently, which is a sign of a good show and how much the characters did care about each other.
Mm. Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, yeah, the character interaction stuff, you know, especially around Artie and the wheel and Claudia's reconciliation at the end, was the highlight, because it's notable that, you know, hardly anything's been said about the artifact plot, because that was really the weak point here. It they just seem to be shifting into cliches of eco-terrorism and even then backpedaling. I mean, it's kind of like, everybody seemed to get off lightly this episode. I mean, you know, Artie was, you know, I mean, so, you know, so they were surprisingly sympathetic, and then it was just kind of odd. I mean, the way they were handling the eco-terrorists, you know, where they were building them up, and then it's like, oh no, it's just, you know, youthful indiscretions, and you know, we're kind of going to let it go because, you know, oh no, we're just here for the, you know, for the artifacts. You know, we're not dealing with the fact that you might have, put people in danger or actually killed people. And, that's not our department. So, you know, that part of it, I did just find strange. And it was just bizarre having this artifact where they never really gave any explanation at all of, you know, where did this lantern come from? Why did it do what it does? That part of the episode I just really felt was not serving the episode well. And, you know, it says, you know, as good as Saul Rubinek is, absolutely, in terms of, you know, conveying what Artie was going through. And, you know, and I kind of like that sense of, you know, it was almost like he was reverting back to the beginning of the series when, you know, when it's like he was the only one there and had to do everything by himself. And getting that reminder of, you know, no, it's not that way anymore. You know, you don't have to feel you have to, you know, make everything right. You're part of a bigger team, a bigger family now. But you know, so that stuff was good. You know, especially if you're going to do some standalones and, you know, stay away from the James Marsters big bad plot, you know, I think they've got to pick up their game on the actual missions.
Yeah. I have a feeling that I'm going to be a little bit more critical of this one than you guys are. This one had me annoyed almost from the start, as perhaps my little jab in the very in the opener for our show might have indicated. I thought that the Regents dismissing Artie's culpability and everything was way too perfunctory and simple. I mean, they did go so far as to basically say that this was a part of him that had kind of grown into another personality to some extent, but there have been people that have been far less damaged that did less to the warehouse in general that were much more harshly punished than Artie gets here. I mean, Artie basically gets time served emotionally, not even like, you know, any type of bronzing or anything else. He basically gets a slap on the wrist and says, now, what, didn't you feel bad after doing that? Okay, don't do that again. It just felt so glossed over. And yes, I understand that the rest of the episode very nicely delved into Artie's emotional state over all this, so that it gave some bit of catharsis to everything, and it demonstrated to, in kind of a show don't tell way, just how bad he felt about everything and how much guilt he was carrying. But I really wish that there had been other consequences to that. It felt like there should have been, and there wasn't. That was very irritating, and it's almost like that was the theme of the episode, because if they softballed and, you know, activist terrorism much more in this episode, it would have been a broad comedy. It seemed like, oh yeah, those were your unfortunate terrorist days or something like that was one line from the show. I was just like, there should be a little bit of a darker side to this, but okay. It just didn't gel for me at all. I mean, it wasn't a terrible episode, but for me, this was definitely not what I was looking for them to do coming out of the exposition dump of the previous episode. So, and not having much of a history for the artifact definitely plays into that feeling. So I gave this one a 6. I was not happy with it at all. Bronze Thumb, I have a feeling that you're going to go in a different direction here.
Yeah, my inclination would be go up to a 7, because it wasn't obvious. It wasn't one of the best episodes ever. There's still a typical warehouse that had problems with sort of A stories that aren't as engaging, but it was. I like the stuff that they did with the characters, and, you know, both the dramatic stuff with Claudia and Artie that was sort of more serious, and then all just the general fun dynamic that this cast have. So, yeah, 7's my vote.
Mm. Gary, how about you?
I'm sort of wavering between a 7 and an 8, given what I've heard. I will back down to a 7. Some of your complaints were legitimate, plus the former eco-terrorists now living in the future with the consequences of their actions is a trope that I've seen pulled out on more shows in the past few years than I can even count, and I wish they would come up with something else. I see it in police procedurals, I see it all over the place, and to see it pop up here was slightly disappointing, and I agree that the Regents could have come up with some sort of unique punishment for Artie for this, and I'm surprised they didn't, given how seriously they consider the abusing of artifacts, regardless of the purpose. So, yeah, I'll go with the 7.
Edmund, how about you?
I'm with you with a 6. I mean, yeah, just that main mission just didn't really gel for me. So, you know, yeah, some of the character stuff keeps it from dropping further, but 6 it is.
Okay, well, there we go. Maybe not so far off from me after all. Whew, okay. All right. Well, let's see if we can bounce back a little bit with the next topic, and that would be Defiance. And here is the promo.
I saw him take the two girls.
Who?
The Bioman.
I've had my eye on the wrong snake.
What is it?
Damned if I know.
Knowledge is power.
Where is she?
You say anything about this, I'll drop your body down a mine shaft.
Defiance, all new this Monday at 9, only on Sci-Fi.
Okay, and let's see. Gary, why don't you go ahead and do the recap for this one?
Yes, we're talking about Defiance, Season 1, Episode 5, A Well-Respected Man. Kenya is kidnapped. Rafe moves a step closer to learning the truth about his son's death. I almost want to call this future Game of Thrones, because really some of the machinations of some of the people are really not that far off. I mean, you have weddings to make alliances. You have, you know, brothers being killed for wrong reasons. It's all, you know, in some ways it does remind me of that. You know, let's see, that being said, we have the we can start off where basically it comes down that that Daytek wants to get on the city council, and he's saying that, you know, he can, you know, help out with things, help smooth things over. The wonderful new sheriff has been screwing up because he didn't know about, I guess, back, I don't know what you call it, I guess, black market gun sales since the force field wall came down. So it's interesting that while the mayor didn't know about it, she really didn't seem that at odds about it. So it makes me wonder about this power structure and how much power the mayor has. They've shown that she's a relatively new mayor, and from the sense of things, that she doesn't have a huge amount of political capital with the people, and so she has to sort of walk a very fine line as far as appeasing all sides as much as she can. But it still struck me that she would be more involved in the security of the town than she actually is, or at least appears to be. That being said, you know, Daytek and his wife both work the the back channels, so to speak, until finally, of course, you know, Daytek does come on to the council, and this is for me the large point of the title of the episode, A Well-Respected Man. You know, Daytek goes on how he's basically treated like scum and dirt rather than the power and influence that he should be, that he exhibits and should be, respected for. And he gets that at the end. He gets what he wants, or at least part of what he wants. That being said, we have the, I guess I'll call it the B plot. I'm not sure how you guys are going to rank this. We have that Kenya, lawkeeper. Girlfriend, I guess, since she's not charging him anymore, as we find out. I guess that's the mark by which you know, again, another Game of Thrones parallel, by the way.
We didn't see anything of Tripod Pain this week.
But so she gets kidnapped and taken by what we find out is a way that human beings, I believe it's just human beings, are being tapped for some type of adrenal fluid that comes out of your brain that they have to basically stick a needle in the back of your head to drain out, because nowhere else works as well as the back of your head. And we have this thing where Kenya is basically sort of living out what I guess is some sort of induced 3D nightmare to make her fear reactions jump up, so she produces extra adrenaline, and somehow, I guess, because of the shocking nature of it or her own willpower, she's able to, or maybe she just tilted the headband off, I can't quite be sure, was able to, you know, get out of this and eventually start to try and get out, pulled her friend out with her, and they're on the run from Bioman, that's that big tough guy that he punched out at the beginning of the season by knowing the off switch. And so you have that sort of getting stalked through the strange neighborhood sort of feel, which I never saw the series going that way, and I can't say I cared for the whole subplot that much of them just running, hiding, hearing things boom, boom, boom. Okay, let's flip back to the town and see what progress Daytek's making. It didn't work for me that well. Of course, she ends up getting saved in the end, so everything turns out okay. But for me, it was just more of a power play episode showing, you know, Daytek get to the top of things. Now there was the whole little, I guess, plot C, if you want to call it that, with the mines, with the father and the brother trying to see what the other brother was originally up to. And while we do get down to the mine and we get to see some really nice cave drawings, we still don't aren't really given that much more information. So that we'll have to wait and see. So, as I said, it felt like there were a lot of machinations going on, and other than Datech getting to the council, nothing else seemed to really move for me in this episode.
Yeah, this felt a lot like those, Bronstum kind of put it a certain way before, that there are certain episodes in the first season of a show, especially one as ambitious as this, where just to give you some kind of background on some of the characters, they do episodes like this, because a lot of this seemed to be designed to flesh out the relationship between Amanda and Kenya, and also to give a better sense of the power behind Datech, and that his wife, I'm assuming, is the real power, and she looks like she does want to be on Game of Thrones, and perhaps borrow Marjorie's wardrobe in the process, but that's how this episode felt to me. And other than the fact that I've always had a bit of a thing for Mia Kirshner, so her running around like that didn't bother me in the slightest.
I didn't think it would.
No. I was feeling this distinct lack of much movement forward with the story. This felt very much like... this felt a little bit like, to go back to our usual thing of Babylon 5 in its first season, like almost like an episode like Survivors for Garibaldi, where it was just, here's some background, we're just doing a standard character, you know, fleshing out episode, no pun intended, and we're just going to get out of the way so that you get this information, and then down the line it'll probably become a lot more important, some of the stuff that we've mentioned, but for now we're just trying to give you the background, and that's what this felt like. And it wasn't a bad example of that by any means. It just wasn't a dynamic episode in that regard. I definitely, the stuff with Datech to me was a lot more intriguing than Kenya's turned out to be, even though that was the initial driver of the episode, it seemed. Be that as it may. Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, advancing the plot, I mean, pretty much the only thing that happened was Datech, you know, making it onto the town council, which for the audience was just, you know, the combination of stuff we'd already seen brewing. And, you know, I guess it was more just for, you know, for Nolan and the other characters to finally get an inkling of, you know, who they're dealing with. Because, you know, I mean, yes, this may be feeling akin to Game of Thrones, but right now it feels like, you know, yeah, one family's playing it a heck of a lot better than anybody else. The whole thing with the Kenya kidnapping, I mean, I am not playing the game, but you know, but to me, it's becoming really obvious, you know, sort of, you know, these segments that are being shoehorned in just because, you know, it's like, you know, no, this, you know, this is this week's game level. And you know, whether it's, you know, the boss fight with the you know, with the hell bugs, you know, or this one where it was, you know, it actually turns out, well, you know, it was a virtual game. And and I will give them credit for, you know, I mean, they did actually set up, I mean, the thing that snaps her out of it. I mean, it was Gary, there was that the St. Finnegan medal that we saw that she had been torn off, and then she has it again in the maze. And that's what makes her realize that, no, this isn't real. And you know, so, you know, I mean, that, you know, that I thought they did a decent job of explaining, but I'm just not sure about how this integration's going on. If it's going to be, you know, no, we have to have, you know, we have to have a video game sequence in every episode.
Well, I thought the boss was that Bio Man.
Yeah.
What it is, I mean, it is a first person shooter MMO kind of game, so I doubt that this would play as much of a level. But I do. That is part of what I feel is, it's not quite holding the show back, but I do feel like they haven't quite found the right way to balance that out yet. That they're still feeling their way out. And you know, Bronstam, I think, even made this point before, that a lot of this would have already been in place a while ago before they really even kind of got their footing. So a lot of the things that are already a challenge for shows that are starting off in their first season, it's being amplified because they've got to have this kind of cross consideration going on. But at any rate, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah. No. I mean, certainly in terms of the episode title, I mean, there's, you know, it's, you know, yeah, I mean, yes, you know, I think, you know, it refers to they tag, you know, most directly, but certainly, you know, you have Nolan trying to get to, you know, make his way in the town and actually, you know, get some respect, and you know, having Daytac, you know, being able to rather easily question his judgment and authority. You know, even though it did feel like, you know, he was trying to shoehorn in, you know, Amanda and Kenya's relationship and give you that background. You know, I thought the one thing we did get out of it was, you know, finally sort of establishing the some of the political dynamic, where, you know, I know that that ceremony at the beginning was her, you know, just being appointed to the role, you know, with this election coming up, which will, I'm sure in a lot of people's eyes, it's like, you know, no, she's just the caretaker, and it's, you know, given the power dynamics in place, you know, it'd be, you know, a stretch at the moment to think that she could actually win the election. So, you know, it's certainly, you know, she's fighting for her respect as well. So, you know, yeah, some decent stuff going on, you know, and certainly, you know, having Daytac and the missus, you know, set up as, you know, these, you know, sort of, you know, rather suspicious villainous characters, but at the same time, you know, the ones who seem to be playing the game better than anyone is, you know, is making for some intriguing complications down the road.
Bronstam, any other things to add for this episode?
No, I seem to have been very insightful already.
Okay.
I don't know, it's I don't really have a lot to add on top of that. Just to say that it was, the political stuff I found far more interesting than the kidnapping, and that I completely agree with the Babylon 5 analogy. This was just okay. We need an excuse to give you a bunch of information.
And what would you give this episode?
Let's see, I'd probably go around a 7. It was average. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't fantastic. I didn't come away from it bored, but I didn't come away from it particularly impressed either.
Yeah, Henry gave it a 7 as well in his review, and I'm actually aligning with a 7. I thought that it was fairly average. Like you said, it didn't really bring a whole lot new to the table, other than a very good look at that Mia Kirshner is keeping herself in really good shape. Edmund, what would you give this episode?
I'm right there with a 7 as well. Some good stuff, some not so good stuff. So yeah, it sticks right in that average slot. You know, nothing to cringe at, but nothing to write home about either.
And Gary, round us out here.
I will go with a more average 6.
Okay.
Yeah, it just, like I said, it felt this whole plot felt sort of one arc big instead of the two arcs that they were trying to push on us.
Three. Yeah, this definitely ranks as by far the lowest scored episode of the season. So that's what happens when you are trying to be more workman with your plotting than, you know, keeping up with all the arcs that are going on. All right, I know that we're running pretty long here, but before even getting to the quick hits, so we'll go through these relatively quickly just to let you see what it is that we've got over on the website. And if you want to get more, we'll go ahead and let you. So let's keep any kind of comments brief, guys. Hannibal here. Brunstone, why don't you give us a little bit of a taste?
Hannibal Season 1, Episode 6, Entree. A copycat murder baffles Jack. Meanwhile, former colleague Dr. Chilton believes that he has the Chesapeake Ripper in custody, and Jack deals with his grief by reaching out to Hannibal. So I gave this episode a 10 out of 10 because in the midst of a ton of other really, really awesome things being on, stuff that we like Game of Thrones and Continuum and Person of Interest and blah, 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 this is probably the best episode of anything I've seen on television this year. It was fantastic. It was loaded to bear with references to the works of Thomas Harris, that ones that even a layman like me who hasn't read the books can pick up on. It had a couple of like really, really fantastic guest performances. Eddie Izzard plays a serial killer in custody and gets to kind of channel the Anthony Hopkins style of Hannibal Lecter as this, you know, this medical doctor who's in prison, and they introduce Dr. Chilton, who's a character in a few of the books, who is appropriately slimy. They pull this great flip on expectations by introducing this character who is not Clarice Starling, but you could totally think it was her, if it gave her another name, you think, okay, this is sort of their way of doing that this character in the show, but they go somewhere interesting with it. But it very directly addressed the core idea of the premise in a way that no other episode of the show has to this point, which is the fact that in the background of a lot of this stuff, there's this very notorious serial killer, the Chesapeake Ripper, who's been running around. He's very smart. He's very methodical. He's extraordinarily hard to catch. He's taken out at least one of the people on the FBI task force sort of out to catch him. Crawford tied up in knots about it. Graham is being groomed essentially to try and catch this guy, and it's playing havoc with his mental. And all the while, none of the FBI characters realize that, like, no, it's their psychiatrist buddy. We of course realize. We sort of realize, like, if you know anything about pop culture, like, you know it's Hannibal. You know that it's Hannibal Lecter is a cannibalistic serial killer. But the show up to this point has really gone out of its way to kind of not tell you that. Like there are some subtle things over the course of the first five episodes, but if you were coming into this not knowing who Hannibal Lecter was, you wouldn't necessarily have picked up on it before this episode. Which is just and it's a testament to just the performance of Mads Mikkelsen, the actor who plays Hannibal Lecter, that he can be just supremely creepy and smart and stuff like that without playing the role the way that Anthony Hopkins did in Silence of the Lambs and all the other ones, because he's not playing the role of a guy who's been busted and is just out to mess with everyone because they all know who he is. Like, he's trying to pass, he's passing for just like an average Joe, albeit one who's incredibly smart and has supremely sophisticated tastes, and it has to be mentioned is a gourmet chef. Like, they go to this fantastic degree with the way that they do it. It's just every single episode has this like little montage of Hannibal Lecter preparing dinner, and it looks like the most delicious damn thing you've ever seen in your life. And he has people over for dinner. He has Crawford over for dinner and Dr. Bloom, and they're all like, oh my god, this is delicious. It's, you know, the best food ever tasted. And if you've seen the show, not the show, like if you know what's Hannibal, you know what's going on. And they just sort of play on that dramatic irony all the time, and this episode just kind of dialed it up to 11. It was a chance for pretty much everyone to kind of do something different with their performances. Great guest stars, great direction, great writing. It was a huge jump in quality for a show that was already fantastic.
All right, anybody else here watching Hannibal right now?
Yep, I actually kind of mainlined a lot of them this week, and I absolutely agree on all levels. It's been absolutely extraordinarily done. So.
Very cool.
If you're not watching Hannibal, then please start watching Hannibal and get the ratings up so we can keep it going for the whole 6-7 year arc that Brian Fuller wants to do. If you are watching Hannibal, then you're awesome. Yay, we like you.
Well, I can guarantee that none of the other shows that we have on this list hit a 10 out of 10. But please go and read more over on the website, even though I think Bronstam pretty much said it all that he said in his review right there. I have an episode of The Borgias here, Season 3, Episode 4, The Banquet of Chestnuts. Anyone who has been studying their history probably knows what this is in reference to. But Cardinal Farnese is placed in the treasury and quickly discovers Versucci's theft. Meanwhile, Alexander calls for a crusade when he learns of Venice's request for help. The Cardinals participate in the Banquet of Chestnuts, and King Ferdinand discovers that Lucrezia and Alfonso's marriage has not been consummated. Boy, two big things in this episode. First was the fact that King Ferdinand decides that in order to assure that Lucrezia and Alfonso consummate their marriage, he asks that one of the Borgias, the family members, also observe the mating with him. And who do they choose? Of course, Cesare, her brother.
Yes.
That was awkward. to say the least. Let's just say that she could not actually enjoy the act until she was sure where Cesare was in the room and could look at him. Yeah. At any rate, then there was the whole banquet of chestnuts, which is you know, this fun little moment that took place at one point where someone, who is still under debate, decided to get the cardinals to get in line with certain political desires by essentially hiring 50 Roman prostitutes to come in and artfully pick up and otherwise manipulate chestnuts, and it was their job to retrieve them. And the more often that they quote-unquote retrieved the chestnuts, that they got prizes, and whoever had the most prizes was the quote-unquote winner. Let's just say that this provided a great deal of blackmail against the Cardinals, and just leave it at that. But to see that kind of play out and how they incorporated that into the various character and plot arcs on the show was interesting, because they kind of moved it about 2 years up in the timeline and also had people involved that normally would not have been involved in this sort of thing, so I give this episode an 8 out of 10. I think that this season continues to ramp things up. It's become quite a good period drama to watch. Meanwhile, Henry gave Orphan Black, Season 1, Episode 6, Variations Under Domestication. Allison's paranoia puts all of the orphans at risk. Meanwhile, Sarah must decide who to trust with her secret. Henry gave this an 8 out of 10, and this was an absolutely insane episode. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Edmund, did you
anyone who's ever had to host a suburban get together,
oh yeah,
knows how insane those can be. So just imagine that plus clones.
Yeah. So I'm guessing you caught up there, Ronstom.
Yeah. No, I'm caught up. Okay. I watched the first three episodes in a run, and I've been on the ball ever since. And yeah, it's a really, really solid show. It's the thing that Ringer wanted to be so badly, yes, but never could, because it had to play on the whole identical twin stuff thing. But yeah, and the glue that holds it together is still the lead actress, Tatiana Maslany, I think, is the name. But yeah, who's playing like about five or six different versions of the character at this point, and they're all distinct, they're all interesting, they're all, like, you can tell them, like, when different clones start like, you know, trying to impersonate other clones, the like, you'd think it'd get so muddled, but you've still, like, it's such a strong performance in each distinct role that, yeah, without someone as capable in the lead, this show would completely fall apart. But
yeah, this is like taking...
really solid.
Yeah, this is taking everything that Fringe did in its third and fourth seasons and just doubling and tripling down on it and doing it incredibly well. I give this episode a 9, personally. I thought that this was just... It just kept on getting worse and worse as far as the situation was, and it just... It went from being on the verge of absurd to just... You were cringing at some of the things that the characters were doing because they don't really hold back. I particularly like the inventive use of the nail gun. Glue gun. Take your pick.
I just like that someone involved in these kind of cloning shenanigans and whatnot just did the perfectly appropriate response and got really, really hammered.
Yeah, there you go.
Which is just like completely in keeping with what this particular character would do, but it all just makes everything so much worse.
Oh yeah. Edmund, what would you give this one, do you think?
The ratings wise, I mean, yeah, this was a 9. I mean, I was amazed at how they managed to have so much spin out of control and yet still kept the story together, you know, because there has been this kind of sense of, you know, well, you know, well, what if these people find out about things? And then they, you know, not only had one character find out, you know, they had, seems practically, you know, just about all of the characters find out, you know, except for the one who suspected in the beginning, who just has to figure out why his wife just went completely nuts.
Oh, yes.
But yeah. And I'm just in case anybody wants to write in, yes, it is Tatiana Maslany, but she is doing an absolutely extraordinary job. And I'm getting to the point where as they're having them interact more and more, it's like, you know, the ADs and the wardrobe and hair people must be going just absolutely nuts trying to keep her and the doubles, you know, together. But yeah, they really are doing it seamlessly.
Yeah, Bronson, what would you give this one, just offhand?
The 8, yeah, I totally agree with the 8.
Okay.
It was so good.
Yeah, and for, I think this is the first BBC America original, at least that's the way they're billing it right now. And
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, it's knocking it out of the park for them, so they've already renewed it for a second season. So that's, yeah, I'm very, very happy with it. It's kind of their continuum in its own little way. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Grimm, Season 2, Episode 20, Kiss from a Muse. Plans for a dinner date between Nick and Juliet go awry due to a muse-like Vesson with influential powers. Elsewhere, Rosalie visits the trailer for the first time. This finally kind of got the whole Juliet, season-long Juliet can't remember everything plot line out of the way in a big fashion. It's the one thing this season that they've taken way too much time to do, and I was very happy with the way that they did it. Yeah, I gave this one an 8. I'm looking forward to how they close out the season. It's been doing pretty well so far. The Vampire Diaries, Season 4, Episode 22, The Walking Dead. Now, there would be a crossover. Jeez. Caroline tries to distract Elena as graduation day approaches, but Elena refuses to be swayed from her new obsession. Meanwhile, patients are attacked at the hospital, and ghosts appear in town when a storm causes an area-wide power outage. I give this one an 8 out of 10. It would be almost impossible for me to explain what was going on if someone didn't know what the rest of the season plot was. Let's just leave it as things continue to go horribly, horribly wrong for everyone. Let's see. Elementary, Season 1, Episode 21, A Landmark Story. Holmes resumes his hunt for Moriarty when Sebastian Moran reveals that Sherlock's nemesis may be responsible for a series of recent murders, including the death of a man who was thought to have died from a heart attack. And Bronstam, you gave this a 7 out of 10.
I did. It would have gotten higher if the actual case to be solved were more interesting beyond the idea of the bad guy. The idea of the bad guy is actually quite interesting because earlier in the season, when they in the fantastic episode M, where they introduced Sebastian Moran, who had basically been he's basically an assassin for Moriarty, and he frames all his kills as these like serial killings. When in fact they're just sort of like essentially a mob hit. And this episode sort of introduced Moran's counterpart, who is an assassin that makes all of his kills look like random accidents. So this is the guy that gets perfect scores in all the Hitman games. And while that idea for that character is cool and the actor does a great job when we finally get to meet the character, the actual case itself I didn't find too interesting. But it ends on a really, really interesting note. And Elementary is kind of, starting with this episode, they're really launching into a kind of end-of-season arc, much the way the first season of Person of Interest did, where a stronger sort of like thematic and narrative connection that I'm really looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Mm. And I think I'm going to skip down to the last one here. Revolution, Season 1, Episode 15, Home. An old flame of both Miles and Monroe re-enters their lives. Aaron's life turns upside down while accompanying Rachel on her trek to the tower. I gave this a 4 out of 10, and I would just say, for everyone's sake, if you really want to know more about this one, just go ahead and go to the website and read the review, because if we get into it here, it's not going to be pretty.
Well, much like this show, yes. It's getting very, what's the word,
terrible?
Formulaic, cliched, and any semblance of originality is going away for me, and I'm losing any care for the characters. At first, I lost care for the main character, then I lost care for Miles. Now I'm pretty much losing care for everyone. I'm hoping that the virus takes over.
Yeah, let's just wipe everyone out, and if they have to have a second season, can they just start over?
Was it officially renewed?
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. Enjoy.
Yes.
Although, given NBC, maybe they can be the first network to rescind the renewal.
Maybe just because they renew it does not mean they will actually show it. So.
Yeah, that's right. It'll be a web series from now on.
No, I don't think we should. I don't think we should give a network the idea of rescinding a renewal. That's going to backfire on us.
Yeah, that definitely will. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter @Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...